Yeah, I did read the book, and I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, well, that's great.
I thought you did a good job of paying your debt.
Of do what?
Of paying your debt that you mentioned.
Oh, that's correct.
Yeah.
Are we on the air?
We're rolling. We're in good shape.
Well, Susie Q, welcome to Alaska, the great land. And I mean a great land, and I think you recognize it already. You made a good trade. Not that I love Indiana any the less, but I love Alaska more. I think we'll put it that way. And we're being discovered now. When I came in here, 30 years ago, before you were born. Maybe before your mom and papa met, I find these things happen. And I'm glad you came, because I think you will like the great land. I came down from Hudson Bay. I was mining up there and had a little airline up in Quebec. I was working out of Rouyn-Noranda, and the war came. Canada went to war. And then the French government just put three Frenchmen on my board of directors and really took over. A radical government came into power. I'd been with the Taché government for 60 years. They'd been in power, and I was getting along fine with them. It really just stopped my operation, and I moved down to Washington, D.C. When a man, when a country goes to war, they shut your money off. They let me have $30. That's all. I could spend it in Canada, but I couldn't take the money out. Well, I landed in Washington, D.C. to get a job building underground storage of aircraft. I knew how to break rock, sink shaft. And I thought we were going underground. But the commission came back from England and said, we're not going underground, we're going to go into diversification of our planes. And I thought that was over there. I had to get a job and go to work again, and I'd pushed the colonel pretty hard for a job when the commission decided to go underground. But it was different now, and I saw the colonel, and he said, we're not going underground, but we can use you. We're going to have trouble in that big, little-known land of Alaska, and we have very few of any men who lived and worked in the Arctic. You've been up in the Arctic of the Quebec, and you know what to do with this white stuff. Would you go to Alaska? I said, hell, I'd be happy to go there. I ran home when I was 15 years old from Seattle and landed in Nome. I long short of Nome when I was 15 years old. Don't ask how long ago that was, Susie, because it was many moons ago. And I said, I'd like to go back to Alaska. You ever been commissioned? I said, I held the command of a National Guard company when I was in university. He's a purple right there. He swore me in as a major, and I came to Alaska. In the spring of 41, it was a great big land, and when I went out to Kodiak, or the Dutch Harbor first, that I left 1,000 men. I was commander of troops on board ship. The St. Mihiel, a reconstructed transport ship, they got out of the graveyard and put it back in service. And we traveled 1 weekend to the west. Dutch Harbor is right west of Washington and not north. I traveled in the setting sun for 7 days. And I realized, arrived at Dutch Harbor, I had my cryptograph man send a message ahead in code that I'd be leaving 1,000 men for them. The Marines were in charge there. Well, I couldn't get the message through. He seemed to be a little bit rusty on his work. He got it off. Message came back. No message came back. I finally sent another message. And a message came back. And we couldn't read it. I had the cryptograph machine out and we worked. My man couldn't do it. And I said to him, I said, what the hell did you say in your message? One came back about the same length and we couldn't decipher. I worked all night on it, gave it up. I arrived at Dutch Harbor. I stepped off the ship as we touched. I saluted the colonel of the Marines. He said, what the hell did you say in your message? I said to you the same thing. He said, call for a drink. We went up to Colonel's headquarters. I put 20 of my men on the job longshoring to unload that ship. And I stayed up at headquarters in Spizzy Camp. The Marines were leaving. Oh, it's a long story. Anyway, I took over command there. The colonel, I put him under guard by an officer about midnight, and they weren't feeding the men. And I went to the captain, and he said, I can't do it in court or in port. The steward is in charge. And I went to the steward. He says, feed the men on shore. I said, you can't feed them on shore. That kitchen and dining room is stacked. You know what that means in college days, stacked. It was stacked. I said, you feed these men. He was then in his stateroom. And he appointed a Filipino, his assistant, to do the job. I took care of the takeover command of Dutch Harbor for good and sufficient reasons. And Captain Ross, the captain of the National Guard of San Francisco, was in charge of 1,000 men and there at Dutch Harbor. And he came to me and said, all they gave us, my men, was coffee. I said, the only 20 men with a damn on this ship are these men unloading this cargo, and I'll see it there fed. I went down and hunted up the assistant that was supposed to feed them, Miss Filipino. I met a man who carried sidearms in a blue uniform he wore, and I thought he was Navy. He stopped a dance one night at midnight without consulting me, and I said, well, let it go, it's time to stop anyway. And I stepped into the kitchen of the commissary department, and I was after that Filipino who was the assistant to feed these men, and he said, you're using pretty strong words there. And he dropped his hand toward his gun, and I clipped him right on the chin. I used to fight in the ring. I KO'd him whenever I fought. I let him have it, and I pulled his gun as he went down. And I said, take this man and put him in chains, to Captain Ross and Captain Woodyard. Woodyard was a West Pointer. He's just coming into service. And put him in chains. I said, I'll prefer charges later on. I went through and quieted down that mob there and straightened him out. And I got to the Filipino, and he was scared, shaking all over. And I had my .45 out this time. And he said, the steward said, only give him coffee. I said, get up that ladder, that steward. And I poked him in the ribs with my .45. He went out of his clothes up the ladder. Went, and I took the butt of my gun at past midnight, and I pounded on the door. I said, don't get up. Just order this man to feed these men and quit this monkey work. Cut out this humalimony. He said, the major is in charge, and do what he says. I fed the men. There was a bet on that the army wouldn't crack the icebox that night for this steward. We cracked the icebox. Well, that's when I arrived in Alaska, and I didn't know that was the indication of what would continue. If you read the book, Susie, Men of the Tundra, one big battle I had. I landed here, this big land. It is bigger than 22 of your smaller states down below. It's hard to comprehend that. There were 65,000 people in Alaska when I arrived, half native, half white. Anchorage, there were 3,500 people here. And they were railroad people, quiet, sleepy, railroad town. And here comes the army in. We were just coming out of tents, and we moved in here. And I was appointed three different jobs with the Air Force. One was Provost Marshal, and I'd cleaned up too many gory messes before the war broke. The morale was terribly low here. And men felt they'd been sent to what we thought is Siberia. I just come back from Siberia, and it's not what we thought. It's a garden land, the south part of it is in Siberia. It's a great country. Well, they were nothing to do here, no place to go, and they couldn't take a lot of something. So I decided to build a service quarters. We had no money for it. We couldn't ship any stuff over the highway, over the marine highway, because the priorities for other material took place of a service club. So I took it. We had men, trucks, and gasoline, lots of that. And I took a bunch of men to Palmer, stand of timber, and got a saw. And we sawed the logs and hauled them in here, and I built a Kashim building. Now, Kashim means in Eskimo, men's meeting place, and that we really needed. It was 40 feet long, 40 feet long and 40 feet wide and 100 feet long, and a great big fireplace built by soldiers, GIs. The engineers said I couldn't do it with them. I went to see them. And I said, I wondered when I came in here when I couldn't help it. I will do it. We are soldiers and we can build a building. I turned around, walked out, and we built it. They didn't know what end of the axe take a hold of. I told them I was a woodsman. I was a bull puncher in the woods of Oregon when I was 15 years old. And I drove horses in the state of Washington. And I used my canoe weekends on Puget Sound. And I knew the mountains and I knew the sea. And I could build a building. And we got it up. I used some, I think, 600 men. They'd take them away from me, one crew after another, and I'd get a new crew. And the war broke right up there. I couldn't get them out of the woods. They liked it up there. They stayed right there. Had a mess up there. We built the Kashim building. It saved a lot of people. It was a great spot. I wish I could tell you about it. The earthquake hit it hard, but they rebuilt it. It's one of the oldest buildings out here, still in service. The Kashim building, a log building. Go out and see it. Now, I'd finished the building by Christmas of the end of 41 and dedicated. And Art Reichel was my lieutenant helping me, and he said, I think maybe I get Joey Brown to come up here. I knew him in Los Angeles, and he worked on my football. I said, get him. What's his address? I sent him a wire. He said he'd come. Then the USO was organized. I said, we'll bring him up there, but they weren't ready. Well, I said, it's time to come now. And I finally, after a lot of molly with the military kicking around, bucking back their orders to me, I sent a wire right over the top of everything. I said, I think a deal with Joey Brown's a deal. Are you coming? He said, a deal with Joey Brown's a deal. I'll be there. He flew a commercial air right up over all the red tape to hold me up. And he came in the night we dedicated the Kashim building. The great Joey, I picked the baton. The news scattered every place. Joey Brown. And it was a great night. The army came to me and they said, take him to every soldier in Alaska. And I gave me a plane, a B-17, and I started out. I covered 30 days and 9,000 miles with Joey Brown, covering all Alaska, clear out to out to Dutch Harbor as far as we went then. And at Nome, he worked hard, morning, noon, and night. And the boys liked him and built him up, and they said somebody at home cares about him. He said to me, Major, have we seen all the soldiers? I said, we've seen all the soldiers, Joe. He said, I want to see Eskimos. I said, anything you want to see, Joe, in Alaska, you'll see. I'll just keep this plane. I inquired around how you want this as it is, do you? Want me to tell it as it was?
Sure.
Okay. I had worked his crew hard for 30 days. You got a couple of days off here. And Joe wanted to go. It was a sunshine day, about 30 below zero. I had a weatherproof plane. And it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I couldn't round up my crew. Joe said, they might be inebriated. I said, no, they're drunk. Some of them do that in Nome. I don't know why, but they do it in Nome. It seems to be a habit. No place like Nome. They just do that. And Colonel Cork was a pilot, and he was okay, and Joe was, and I was, and I'd had a bunch of other people I picked up on this plane to go along with me just for fun. So I said, we take off. It's only 175 miles out there. We took off. I got in trouble. Lost one of the two engines. A Williwall was coming in, and we got down, emergency landing on a lake on St. Lawrence Island. And about 70 Eskimos came, I don't know where from, and the willy wall was getting stronger. That's a wind, a downdraft, and it blow your plane away. Anything else? And no trees grow on St. Lawrence Island. Only willows as big as a thumb creep on the ground. Nothing to tie to on that lake. And I said, about 70 Eskimos showed up there. I said, you got to cut an ice bridge under this wing and tie it down. I gave them the tools to cut into the ice and tie into it. Under this wing. And they did it. Now I said, you got to fill it with water. Now, Susie, there's no water in an Eskimo village at 30 below zero. If you've been there, you know. It just doesn't exist in the igloo or out. They filled it with water. But this is all important. This is the beginning of a great institution that affected a whole race of people. This very act that happened right now. How did they fill the water? They just zippered down and pissed it full of water. And it froze right now, and it held the ship. I looked, set back. I said, these fellows know everything. They had to know everything to survive 6,000 years in this rugged country. But they never, ever impose on you their knowledge. right then and there, they're so magnificent and help me repair this ship and get it back in shape. Then I wrote the defense of the Arctic by Eskimos. It stuck. I got the order through. When bombs fell on Dutch Harbor, my orders cleared. It takes bombs sometimes to clear orders through the gigantic military red tape that we have. You recognize now I'm a little irritated with red tape. And I went to work. And I took Joey Brown with me over Alaska and over to St. Lawrence Island. And he was great. He put on some programs for them. They liked him very much. They were there 3 days. And when he left, the village council came, 4 or 5 of them. They said, had a scroll wrapped around a piece of driftwood, and he unwrapped it. And it said, Joey Brown, come to our village, March 18, 1942. Make everybody laugh, have good time. Every day after this, March 18, will be known as Joey Brown Day. We do no work, have no school, just sit around, think about Joey Brown. He cried. These are great people. For 10 years, I walked in the muckalucks of the Eskimos, a most great, wonderful people that ever lived on the face of the earth. You know, they thought at one time they were the only people on the whole world. They were isolated by themselves. And they survived. They lived off the land. You hear people today, long-haired guys, living off the land. I don't know about that. But they lived off the land. That's all there was. There's no other people here. And they lived off the land, and they kept a happy life. I walked high adventure by air, by land, by sea, and by dog team. On the trail of the Eskimo, I made all the villages time and again for 10 years in organizing the native people. I asked them to defend up, to stand up and defend their shores, and they stood up, Susie, and defended their shores. Not one man refused to join the colors. It's the ATG, Alaska Territorial Guard, that I signed them up, the same oath that the regular soldier takes, and it was without pay. But they defended their shores. Until this time, they thought of Uncle Sam sort of Santa Claus. He came with missionaries and songbooks, and he told them nice stories. And, you know, the missionaries found out that when they told them about hellfire, they said, tell us some more about that. They'd been cold all their life. They wanted to know more about that hellfire that burned forever. And that was much interesting to them. But the missionary and the teacher got control of them. The Kashim was underground, largely built with driftwood and whalebone, jaws of the whale. They lived in ivory towers, lots of them. The homes are built. Frame of ivory tower. We live in ivory towers, and they lived in actual ivory tower. a home built of jawbones of the whale and covered with sod. And these people rallied to the colors like no one else. My youngest soldiers were 13 years old at Point Lay. I'd gone there by boat, and I'd organized them, and went out to that boat about 2 in the morning. There's no night here at this time of year right now with long days here. We got 20 hours of sunshine. It's shining right now, bright and clear, and clear, crystal clear air, free as can be. And they came out to my boat, and they wanted to join the ATG. I said, well, where were you when I organized the company? We were out caribou hunting. Did you get any caribou? We killed 7 caribou. We bring in 2. We go back tomorrow, get the rest of them. I says, if you can kill a caribou and bring him in, you can take care of a job. Hold up your right hand, and I swore them in service. They were the youngest soldiers I had. And the oldest soldier, mushing down the Yukon with an Eskimo dog musher, and he told me as they came toward Androsky, it's a town now called St. Mary's on the Yukon, it was then called Androsky from a Russian name. And he said that an interesting man lives here about 2 miles out of Androsky. He told me about him. I said, we'll stop and see him. We pulled up to the steps that lead up from the river up to his log cabin, about 20 steps up. Parked the dogs, anchored them there, went up, and he was lying down in a bunk at 2 in the afternoon, his Eskimo family around him, and I talked to him. He told me about his father, who was a soldier at St. Michael's, and he was there, and he was half Eskimo and half Russian. He was sired by this Russian to an Eskimo woman. And he was there when the Russian flag came down and the Stars and Stripes went up. That's as near as I got to that scene. He was 5 years old, we estimate. 5 or 6, he knew some of the occasions that time. He said his father decided to stay in free America, and he said he conquered the Yukon and the Kuskokwim. He was a trader. It was a dog team, he'd carry stuff in and sell it to these Eskimos. But he was killed by a Nulato Indian as he was leaving Nulato. One of his boys killed an Indian in those days, a life for a life, a tooth for a tooth. So he paid with his life for the life that his Eskimo boy took. I said, Paul, tell me about yourself. He said, no, I tell you a story. What you do here? You tell me a story. That's fair enough. I said, I'm here to organize the Eskimos into fighting battalions to defend themselves against the enemy. There's an enemy out here on the shores now preparing to come in. There's 10,000 Japs out on Aptu and Kiska, and they're going to come in. We've got to stop them with bullets. We either kill them or get killed. I want you to, your people, to stand up and fight them off. He said, I like to kill Jap. He said, many times I'm hungry up here. Jap out there, get our fish. It's going on right now. Sure. They're taking the fish still. They were doing it way back when, Paul Kashevna was 85 years old now. And he wanted to kill Jap. That's great. That's the right spirit. We get lots of them to stop. The only way, war is war, and you kill or get killed. And I said, that's great idea. I'm glad you feel that way about it, but you're a sick man. I didn't want him. He got right up. He says, I'm not sick. I'm just resting. Well, that's for a soldier. That's the thing to do when you're not working. I still didn't want him, and I said, but Paul, you've got no eyes to see to shoot with. You know, glasses, squinty eye. He picked a rifle off the rifle rack of the wall. He stepped on the porch and said, Major, pick out target. I said, that cannon down. He put it right in the end of it. I still didn't want him. An old man, 85, has knotty legs and bowed, and I said, but Paul, you got no legs to travel with. He turned on me and said, Major, I'm not running. I should have when I get here. I said to my Eskimo dog musher, go down that sled and get an Enfield rifle and 150 round bandolier of ammunition and a shoulder patch. And I personally pinned the shoulder patch on him, and I said, "Paul, you're a soldier. You defend your camp here." He became a good soldier. He died 2 years later up the river about 200 miles with his crew. The first Eskimo I signed up was at Kwagilinuk on the Kuskokwim River near the Bering Sea. I called them together in the Kashim, and I told them the story, what I wanted them to do, that the enemy was coming. And they said, "We'd be happy to be Uncle Sam Man." Then I had Ray Christensen, a 16-year-old boy who knew Eskimo and English. I said, "Tell it to him what I told him in Eskimo." And he got the same answer. "We'd be happy to be Uncle Sam Man." I had about 150 in there. To digress a little bit, Ray Christensen, I saw him at the Anchorage West Hotel here some years later after that. He was then flying commercial job for Ray Peterson, the Consolidated Airlines, getting $16,000 a year, married a white woman, and is a member of the Territorial Senate. I said, "Ray, how'd you come to do it?" He said, "You told me I'm just as good as anybody, and I believed you." And he came all the way up. We have those people. They're great people. Their IQ is just as good as ours. You just give them the inspiration and point the way, and they'll go.
Want to fix yourself some more coffee?
No, I'll go on a little while longer on this.
Okay.
Let's cut it off here and have a cup of coffee.
Okay. I'm just going to let you talk informally. Don't... Go ahead.
I had a table of chairs here, and I got this jade table. It's low, and we sit on cushions around here. I can seat 7 people for a cocktail party, 5 for a dinner, and it's much better. I got a guest. I can see the whole guest. The table, all you see is their head sticking above.
Yeah.
Here I see the whole guest. She's got a miniskirt on. It's terrific. I see the whole body, and I can talk to it, and it changed my way of life, it has.
You have a lot of beautiful things here.
Well, thank you.
Jade and
I like jade. I bought this back from Russia just last week. It's a samovar. Bought it in Moscow. I haven't used it yet.
It's beautiful. You even have some jade dice.
Yes, I got a pair of jade dice there.
Oh, that's a good
one. Jade to the Chinese and the Japanese is a way of life. The other piece of this nugget went to Japan for jewelry. Mm-hmm. That nugget... That table weighs 360 pounds. Intrinsic value within is a couple of $1,000. Mm. Made into jewelry, it'll run between $30,000 and $40,000. Made into jewelry. Jade right there.
Did the Eskimos use jade before you went to Jade Mountain?
They used jade for tools. I dug in the ancient igloos in Tigra. That's a spot 5 miles from Point Hope, where the biggest village known. The University of Alaska said there were Eskimoid people there 2,600 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's 600 green spots. They say that's where an igloo was. I couldn't believe it. I dug down and found the seal oil lamp and jade tools. Mm-hmm. During the Stone Age, the Eskimo used jade instead of stone. It's much tougher than stone. Jade has a toughness of 7.5. And next hardest is diamond, which is 10. It takes diamond or carbon in the mud to cut jade. The only thing will cut it. And so they use the tools. I have some right there. You look at them right now. Tools made by the Eskimos back in the Stone Age. Jade runs all the way from black to white. I have some black jade adze there and some knives that I dug out of their ancient igloos. I said to an old Eskimo who's there when I found these jade tools, I said, "Where did you get the jade?" He said, "From Jade Mountain." I jaw dropped on my chest. My eyes were big as saucers. I said, "Where's Jade Mountain? I had never heard of Jade Mountain." First chance I got, I went. There was Jade Mountain in all its glory. It's not solid jade. They're great big nuggets as big as a house sticking out of a mountain. And there was 100 tons laid at the bottom
of the mountain at Shungnak River, headwater Shungnak. Now, in Eskimo, Shungnak River means jade. This Eskimo said, high in the Arctic is Jade Mountain. A headwater of Shungnak River is Jade Mountain. Now, Shungnak in Eskimo means jade. And I went, and there it was, and I brought out this 164-pound nugget, and a war correspondent wrote a story, and the rush went to Jade Mountain. It's now a multi-million dollar business. I come to talk to you, Susie, you want to talk about Eskimos. I'll get right back onto my story that I got off when I got this coffee. Coffee's very nice, thank you. And I'll go back on the story of the Eskimos at Kwagilinuk on the Kuskokwim River. I had them all together in the Kashim. As I told you, that's a building where means men's meeting place. It's built of driftwood and whalebone and covered with sod. I had about 150 in there. And I told them a story, and I got the answer, we happy be Uncle Sam man. I said, I'm ready to sign you up. And there stood before me a solid citizen. The average Eskimo is 5'4". I measured thousands of them. Literally thousands of them for uniforms. And those who live off the sea, kayak, are a little shorter, maybe 5 feet tall, and with parka is 4 feet broad. So a solid citizen stood before me. And all the records Uncle Sam gives you to fill out. We're in a paper world, Susie, and I hate it. We're being covered with paper, red tape. And I had him there, and I said, what is your name? He gave me his name. I wrote it down. I said, how old are you? He looked at me rather strangely. He said, I don't know. I'm old enough and not too old. He stood 5 feet tall, looked me square in the eye, said, what you want done? I said to myself, brother, you'll do. I wrote down the age that Uncle Sam wanted. We had an enemy on our shore out here, and here's a man going to help me get him off, and so I didn't monkey with this red tape. Regulation West Pointer probably been there yet, trying to find out the age of this man. Better delete that. We have to delete that part. And so I put it down, and I signed up 3,700 of those men, and I put the age down Uncle Sam wanted, and they were a rugged fighting force the enemy would have met. They'd come in. Now, we, ATG, picked up 18 of the 22 or 3 Jap balloons that hit Alaska. They were big balloons, about 100 feet in diameter. They carried bombs and incendiary bombs, and we were most fearful of them carrying germ warfare. And these Eskimos picked them up. They put out incendiary fires created by these bombs in the tundra, and they picked up men. They were decorated. Pete Bleasdick at Ohagamut on the Yukon River sighted the first balloons coming over, 3 of them. And he opened fire on them. He was a sergeant in a little unit at Ohagamut on the Yukon. And he got his dog hicked up and he went down to Marshall. It's called Fortuna Ledge on the map, ordinarily called Marshall, where a captain of the ATG was in charge of that area and reported what he found. The captain at Marshall of the ATG, his name was Marshall, sent the message and it was grounded at Flat, a place called Flap, where the Air Force carried its communications center and went on through. They sent a report from an Eskimo and they didn't send it on through, they killed it. 10 days later, Pete knew he got some lead into one of those balloons and he followed it and he found one of the balloons. He cut the Jap marking out, hooked his dogs up and down the Yukon, 33 miles he goes again, and delivered it to the captain of the guard there, and then action took place. The message went through. They believed the Eskimo. They didn't at that time. And men from the intelligence department, combat intelligence department, were there, and they went out and got the balloon, and they came when we found them and got them. One Eskimo was on a trap line, and he found this strange balloon. He gathered it up, but saw his dog sled. He sleeps in it nights and gets back to his village after a few days, and had a live bomb in it all the time. He slept with that. So the Eskimo did valiant service, and his real service today, he is now in charge of the Eskimo life of the village. And I'll go back farther. The missionaries couldn't quite control them underground in the Kashims, and they said, Jesus wouldn't like that, what you do down. They have dancers down there. Well, beautiful dancer world. They don't even touch each other. If they have any dancing wrong, your generation has them now. Not them. Here's the most delightful dance in the world. And they discouraged it, many of them did. Well, they let the Kashim die. And then this is fundamental in the life of the Eskimo. Susie? Then they had no place to meet. That's where the boy, when he was able to get along without his mama, he joined the Kashim. They lived in the Kashim, the men did. That is where the old men ran the government, taught this boy how to build a kayak to fit him, to balance him. It was a very delicate instrument, and he was taught there how to make the kayak to fit him, and so forth. Well, now they're out of ground, above ground. There's no place to meet. You can't run a government at 40 below zero. You can't meet. You can't organize. So they had to go to the school or to the mission. That's the only place they could meet. I was in Point Hope 30 years ago when the Eskimos came over and said, we'd like to have dance Saturday night. Yes, the teacher, BIA teacher too, said, no, not this weekend. Maybe next weekend. He was making homebrew. That's what actually happened. He didn't want them there. I was living with him weekend. Well, now that breaks down all government when they can't meet, when they can't get together. So I realized that fundamental situation, and we began to build Kashims, armories, you want to call it. I call them Kashim, for these natives in their village, and I gave them the key. I used surplus material I bought from Nome. Now, the National Guard, under General McCrossan, have built 65 nice armories in 65 villages. The Eskimo has the key to it. One more dance, they can have it. Government is now returning to the Eskimo people, and they're going to run their government. And the ATG did a great job. There was a vacuum which it didn't get moved into. Today, they are the leaders of the people, and they have 65 Kashims, armies you call them, and they have their dances and their social life there, and it's also used for military as the first call on. I was called back into service. The Switter, believe it or not. That's the answer I give when you ask how old I am. Same answer that the Eskimo gave me. I hope you'll take that. Many moons ago, but this last winter I was called in. They were having some difficulty. The scouts, I transferred over from the ATG. I spent 4 years in the National Guard. The governor came and saw me in 46, I quit the service, war was over, and 2 years later he came and got me to go back and take those ATG people and transfer them over to the National Guard. So that's what made the National Guard. And they were resigning. And the general called me in, he said, we're having some difficulty, we don't know just what it is. Have you got any suggestions? I says, yes, sir, I have a suggestion. I suggest you put Major John Schaefer, Jr., who is an Eskimo from Kotzebue, who is a major qualified under your National Guard regulations, headman and scout battalion number one in Nome. Has 500 men on him. And no white men over it to jerk the strings. They're just getting tired of some white man jerking the string all that time. I think he'll help you. They called me back later and said, we've taken your advice, but Major John Schaefer wants you to go with him and see the Eskimos, find out our problem. I said, I'll be happy to go back. I thought it'd be all your own. They gave me a plane, and I went with John Schaefer and one of the generals of the National Guard, and I had a moving picture, which is, you should have the moving picture. It's a story. I made three pictures. I have one out now. I finished about a year ago. It's the early life of the Eskimo. When I met him 30 years ago, he lived the same he lived for 30 years, for six generations. And he was wearing labrys and so forth. And I had that picture. And a great funeral, Moses' funeral in Nunavak Island. And you should have it for your records. I use it once in a while. It should have more exposure. The Arctic Laboratory in Barrow have one copy. Well, I'll get back onto my subject now, if I can. What was I talking about, Susie? Where was I?
Well, you started to talk about when they disbanded, and then you got back to where they called you last winter.
Well, I was called back into service, and I went out with them. I used this picture to get them together. I have 900 single meetings. You can't organize people if you get them together and talk to them. It's difficult today with the radio, the television. They don't leave it. They don't care for public meetings. But this picture, they came. They set a big poster out, said Muktuk is returning to the Arctic, and they came to see me. They knew me. I picked them up. I'm their Abraham Lincoln. Now, I'll tell you the real trouble I had was the white trader, the shippers, the politicians were all organized, and they had that Eskimo organized as a second-class citizen. He was an economic slave. That's what he was. The white trader had control of the supplies, and he bought the furs, and he gave him money good for only in his store. So no matter what he paid the furs, he jumped his price up to make himself whatever he wanted. His conscience was only his guide, and sometimes the conscience got weak. I know they were selling old, the Eskimo liked his old World War I tight lace breeches that they knee down. And the trader there, I won't name him, he's dead now, he was buying them for about 20 cents a pair and selling them for $20 in Selawik. And Paul Ballett, the lieutenant in charge there, he wanted me to come to, he heard about this OPA, Office of Price Administration. He said, we charge them too much. I said, I can't come there. I'm a military man, strictly, and I can't get into that. But they had the meeting, and they sent it in and said that the major was there, and they used me in all many ways. And I got in all kinds of jams that way. And the OPA man came out, McCutcheon, Steve McCutcheon. He was an OPA administrator here. And he said it was too high, and they had to cut the price down. Well, now that white trader is a pretty ingenious man. He just went right around them. They were getting muskrats then. Muskrats are worth $2 a skin. He said, pants, 10 muskrats, one pair of pants. That's $20. Went right around the OPA just like that. And they carried on. The white trader was ruling the Arctic. He was the boss in the Arctic. And he didn't want anyone to interfere with his income. When you trample a man's income, you've got trouble. And I had that problem. He didn't want me to organize the Native. They tried to get rid of me. The book, you'll understand why I had all that trouble. I had to stand the Attorney General of the Territory of Alaska up in the North Pole Bakery in Nome. He came in there. When Bob Butler ran for delegate to Congress, he ran for the same office. Yeah, I went in for breakfast. He picked his lunch up, came over and sat across the table from me. He said, Major, when are you going to start your political campaign? I said, Mr. Attorney General, he's dead too now, but I won't name him. I don't like what you say, and I don't like the tone of your voice. Elucidate. He said, when are you going to start running guns out ahead of me to get votes for your friend Bartlett? And Greening was sponsoring Bartlett. I said, we're wearing sidearms then. I was in uniform. I said, stand up. Get up. There were about six people arrested. I had to meet opposition when it came, or they'd driven me out. They intended to drive me out of the attic. Now, let me tell you the story of the native people. The white man thought them as childlike. I said, I've contacted 1,000. Everyone has joined up. I asked them to stand up and defend their shores, and they are standing up as I get to them. I want to tell you that if you interfere with a military organization in time of war, and I can prove it on you, the penalty is death. And Mr. Attorney General, I don't mind shooting you or anybody else gets in front of this military army. I'm going to build this native army. You understand that? He was white as a sheet now, and he wanted to shake hands, and I said, you're a politician. You mean it? He says, yes. I shook hands. It's all over. I had to deliver that message to three of the highest ranking men in the territory of Alaska. This man was a member of the cabinet of the governor, whom I was my commanding officer. He said he asked for it. So that was the problem I had, and I took on all comers because I decided to organize these great and wonderful Eskimo people, the greatest people any man ever met. I walked high adventure by air, by land, and by sea, and by dog team. The governor said, I'm the only man to ever see all the Eskimos. And I saw them time and again. My beat was 154th parallel west. That's a line from Barrow down to Kodiak Island. And it is bordered, that piece of land, by the Beaufort Sea on the north, by the Arctic Ocean on the northwest, by the Bering Sea on the southwest, and the Pacific Ocean surrounds that piece of property. It went from Butter Island out to Attu. The first man killed was a teacher at Attu. I had told him I'd be out there and organize them at Attu. That's the last island on the Aleutian chain. It's 1,500 miles out from the mainland. And before I got there, I said, oh, what I want is information of the enemy. Suddenly, the Jap fleet arrived in there, and he, according to the first story, made for the radio shack to communicate with me. I'm not sure it's true from notes we found on the Jap bodies. But that was what he was there for, the information. That's what the ATG was for. Eyes and ears for the Army, intelligence. The duty of a scout is to observe, report, harass, retard, and fall back when overpowered. And the information is what we really wanted. And they could do that. And they were qualified and were able to do that. They picked up a Navy ship that was shot down by Russians and landed in the sea near St. Lawrence Island, rescued all five of them, and they were decorated for that. On the Yukon at Ruby, a plane went down and they found all but the sergeant. And they couldn't find him. And the ATG got out of maneuvers and they came in. They said, they told them their problem. They said, well, we go hunt for him. We've been 3 days on trail, but we hunt. Well, they found him. They didn't know the angles in the snow. There was an angle out there that was different. But there, it had been snowed and our sergeant was there. He was dead. But there was a different angle and they picked him out quick. And they were decorated for that. And they had several decorations by the Army, and the Army of today says the Eskimo soldier, the scouts, as they're called, is the best soldier they ever had for Arctic duty. They meet every year out here 2 weeks. You'll see 1,000 of these men come in here. First time I brought them in here, the first time they ever walked on pavement was here. And the people here said, who are we? We invaded? Who are these people? I said, just your brown cousins. Well, I said, live up in the Arctic, 1,000 miles from here, out along the shore of the Bering Sea and the Arctic Ocean. Most rugged, real people. You see them here, maybe you don't think so, but you put them on a trail and they're the best soldier the Army ever had for Arctic duty. That's the story of the ATG. I could talk to you on many things. I don't like what's happening now. I was a member of the Council Convention, met in your town of Fairbanks for 75 days. It's a cool, rugged country. I respect you, Fairbanksons. You can take it. And we are a sovereign people, Susie, up here. But we are not being treated now as a sovereign people. A bunch of people from the outside, bird watchers, I call them, are telling us how to run this country, what to do with it. Want to put it all under reservation for wilderness sake. For wilderness sake. They've closed us all up to it. They've stopped this oil debate. They've stopped this pipeline. We're in trouble here now. I'm in the building business. I'm building 100 homes. I got no market for them because that pipeline has been held up. The ecology boys, we never heard that word in the region. We don't know how to spell it yet, but it's every place. And they want to protect our wolves. And to hell with the caribou and the moose, they don't know what they're doing. One caribou can kill as high as 70, one wolf can kill as high as 70 caribou in a year. He likes hot meat. He'll follow the herd. I know. I followed him. I think we should start a program to defend, to protect the rattlesnakes and the people down below. Same thing. They don't know what they're talking about. Their idea is great, but it's wrong. Now they, these bird watchers, I'm a member trustee of the Yukon Dam, the Rampart Dam. We had it all over, engineered past it. We need that power now. It had been the biggest power plant in the free world. And they stopped it. I'll tell you how they do it. There are so many of them, they write their congressman, they write their senator. Until he doesn't make a decision, he just withdraws and makes no decision. That is not the democratic way of we're supposed to run this country. They can kill a man on issue before it comes to a hearing by their writing to them and pulling him up. Now, they had a hearing here. Former partner, Wally Hickel, in the building out here he was. He's trying to give 10,000 acres down here at Cropper Center to the bird watchers. That's as big as two small states. We're a big land. And I'm not all for it. I said, I'd be for it if you let an Alaskan organization run it. But you take it to Washington, D.C., it's dead. Let us make the mistakes if it can be made. We'll make them. And we'll make less than you make down in Washington, D.C. We're a sovereign people. We should be treated as sovereign people. We lost Greening and Bartlett. They had standing on committees. They could take care of us better. Now they've got a couple of freshman senators down there, and they're just running right over us. Now, in the great, we have more coal here than any part of the United States. And they decided when coal was the king of all power, the coal men of Pennsylvania and so forth, through Congress, decided to preserve the coal of Alaska and keep it for posterity. And we don't need it now. And the bird watchers today are trying to shut this great field of oil up. The world, maybe the world's biggest deposit of oil lies in the Arctic. It's a great big wasteland. I wish these fellows that yell about this destroying the virgin country would see that once. They were doing no damage up there. Now, we were getting to be a second-class power, Susie. We were losing our oil. It was running out in 10 years. If you don't have your own oil, you're not a first-class power. If you got to depend on some other nation. This discovery on the North Slope put us back in the first-class power for all time. That will last for 50 years. We're taking out 2 million barrels a day will run for 50 years. We don't know how much more will be discovered up there. But they're now trying to close that up. These bird watchers would close that right down if they could. That's their intention. We're a sovereign people. We're going to be treated as sovereign people. And my message to you fellows who are running this country, you run your own country. You messed it up. We'll take care of this country. If any mistakes make, we'll make them. But we're going to do a better job than you will. But right now, they've got us stymied on that pipeline. I think Mr. Hickel should have issued the order, which he could have. Birdwatcher got him under control, I think. And they've quieted him down. He should have given the order, put the pipeline in, and we had it flowing. That's our great wealth. The nation needs that to keep us a first-class power, that reserve of oil. Now, I don't want to go any farther. I've gotten away from the Eskimo, but the Eskimo will go along with us. He'll not stop that pipeline. We just give him a job and give him his fair shake. And we're going to make this settlement, I think, of the Eskimo. My advice to them is to make the best deal they can make, but make it now. they'll never be in a better shape to make a deal. It won't be exactly what they want. I'm on the side of the Eskimo all the way. It's his land, and this Uncle Sam's ready to give him $1 billion. That's a lot of money. It's a lot of anything. And we've got 20, 40, maybe 100 billion barrels of oil in Alaska. And that's our bid for a first-class power for all time. Mm-hmm. Let's begin to take this oil out. We'll take care of the ecology. We'll protect it. It's been done all over the world, and it'll be done here. Half of Alaska's mountains will never be touched. They'll always be there. This hue and cry about the ecology is going too far. I'm all for pure water, and I think we can clean up a little. And we will. But let us do it. That's the only message I got to the outside world. And they're coming here by this town, the mayor says, will double in 5 years. We're now over 100,000, maybe 120,000. In 20 years, I've seen a jump from 3,500 to 120,000 people. I predict in the book I have, Men of the Tundra, that it'll double in 10 to 12 years. Now in the book, The Men of the Tundra, I could have told you a story about the little men. Uncle Sam fought 2 battles and won them. I never reported it. It's a battle against the little men. But it wouldn't have, the white man wouldn't have understood it. The book, Men of the Tundra, was to give the Eskimo image a place in the sun, a compliment, which he's entitled to. And that's what I did with that book. I gave him a place in the sun and an image, what they need. And there are 3,700 heroes that I recorded at the back of that book. Men who took up arms and defended their shores. Now, this could go on for days, Susie. Let's knock it off now.
Okay, there's just one thing I'd like you to recount, is how you got your nickname, Muktuk.
Oh, the nickname Muktuk, Susie. This True Magazine wrote that whole story 25 years ago. I came into Point Hope. My dog team had made 65 miles. That's about all I can make in a day's time. I tried to make 85 miles one time from Teller to Nome. Sammy Mog was my dog musher. We took off from Teller, and we got to Sinrock, a place about 20 miles from Nome. And we went in for tea, and it was warm. It was 30 below zero, and we kind of softened up, and the Eskimo women take your garments right off, hang off and dry them, and then you get you tea and something to eat. And I dozed, and I got up to go out. And the Eskimo said, Major, we short of tanning fluid here. Yours is just as good as ours. And he handed me a pail, and before the women and the kids, I contribute to the welfare of a whole race of people. What have you done, Susie? And we didn't make the 80 miles. We stayed all night right there. But I came into Point Hope after 65 miles. You're tired. The dog mush is the hardest working dog in the team. I had 14 dogs just mushing through there. Always had a good dog, English Eskimo with me. He's the best dog man there is. And I parked my dogs outside of my friend whom I knew well, and I crawl in, have a tunnel, and you come up to the dome-like place, and he was just having dinner. And it was Muktuk. And the Eskimo was taking out lots of slabs of Muktuk, and we were eating, and it's hot in there. We stripped to the waist. We tell many, the Eskimo likes to visit. He visits all night. He wants to know about the neighbors around, the last world. And we visit, and we much laughter and much talk, much eating. Finally, I got up. Now, in the Arctic, they have champion eaters. And he said, you through? I said, no, I'm just straightening out. I'm going to settle down and have dinner now. He said, I give up, you champion. I was in a contest, won the contest, and didn't know I was in the contest. Well, that's the story as it goes.
That's great.
I'll give you a new cup of coffee.